Hi everyone, welcome to a special mini episode of the David Bowie podcast, Album to Album. I'm Arslan Hamid and this is my Easter weekend gift to you. It's basically a few outtakes from the podcast that I put out last week featuring Nick Pegg talking about Never Let Me Down. Nick began our first recording by telling me a little bit about how the book The Complete David Bowie came to be. So I couldn't quite find a place to fit that, so I'm sending it out here. And then also, Nick made some very good points about Live Aid and about Bowie's theatricality during the Glass Spider tour. So that is also here. The reason I didn't include that in the original podcast is that my microphone packed up for that section. So you can hear my groans and grunts in the background while Nick discourses volubly on the subject of the Glass Spider tour. And as usual with Nick, it's fascinating, it's insightful, and it really does need to be heard. So here is your Easter egg from me, your Easter peg, if you will. And I hope you enjoy it. And I'll see you next week for our next edition of the podcast, Album to Album, in which we will have another repeat guest coming back with another album that we're going to chew over. So do join me for that. Till then, have a wonderful Easter weekend. And thank you for all the reactions and all the likes and everything. It really, really is very heartwarming indeed. Okay, bye-bye.
My name is Nicholas Pegg. I'm a writer and I'm also an actor and a theatre director occasionally. Jack of all trades and master of none, I suppose. But among other things, I'm a great big David Bowie fan. And I suppose I originally came to write my book, The Complete David Bowie, which has been around for quite a few years now, because at the time I'd read quite a few biographies. I was already a big David Bowie fan, and there were a few books around, some of them very good indeed. But there wasn't a book that examined David Bowie's work rather than his life. And it's a fascinating life, and of course his life is important to his work. But I'd read quite a few biographies. I'd read all about the sex and the drugs and the rock and roll and all that, and it's all very interesting stuff. But what I hadn't read was a book that anatomized and analyzed and looked at all his, and also gave equal weight to all of his work. You know, of course, understandably, we're all fascinated by the Ziggy Stardust period and that, you know, golden decade of the 70s. But certainly at the time that I started working on my book, which was the late 90s, mid to late 90s, at that time, Bowie hadn't yet been, what should we say, rehabilitated as the sort of, by the time it came to the 2000s, you know, albums like Heathen and so on, I think, you know, David Bowie was back in the pantheon and was a hugely respected, but I think people slightly forget now that in the 90s, when he was producing, in my opinion, some of his most interesting work, albums like Outside and Earthling, the critical prevailing opinion was still fairly harsh. And
you couldn't get arrested for it.
No, absolutely.
And that period in The Enemy when around that time, the mid-90s, and he was really getting a kicking.
Yeah, that's right. He couldn't seem to do anything right. And yet an album like Earthling, for example, was, you know, an awful lot of people were just going, oh dear, what's Grandad trying to do now?
Grandad goes drum and bass.
Yeah, exactly. And I thought these albums were terrific. And I still do. I mean, I listened to Earthling again a while ago for the first time in a while. And wow, I mean, and like so many of Bowie's things, at the time it was a bit of a shock. Yeah. You listen to it now, I think it's more interesting and has more depth and more, intellectual heft behind it than an awful lot of the music that he was clearly, you know, being influenced by at the time. That's not to denigrate other drum and bass stuff, of course, but I mean, I think that's just a fantastic album. So anyway, I wanted there to be a book that treated all of his work with an equal amount of, you know, gave it an equal amount of consideration. And also, of course, his films and his videos and everything. And so I rather pompously thought, well, if no one else is going to write this book, I'll have a go. And I started making little notes and things. I was actually working as an actor on a theatre tour at the time I first started doing it, because I can remember sitting in dressing rooms, you know, just scribbling down little notes. And I did a few sample bits and bobs and eventually got to the point when I sent them off to a few publishers, got a few polite no thank yous from people who thought that David Bowie wasn't, you know, I've got it still somewhere in a filing cabinet. I got a letter from one quite big publisher, which literally is more or less word for word. They said something like, we don't think that this book will appeal to anyone beyond David Bowie's ever dwindling band of hardcore devotees. So fair enough. There you go.
Our groups are on their way out.
Exactly. Yeah. that sort of thing. So anyway, eventually I found a publisher who didn't think that, and the first edition came out actually in 2000. At the time the first edition came out, the most recent album was Ours. Yeah. And since then I've updated it quite a few times, and most recently, of course, after David Bowie very sadly died in 2016, later that year I did a great big update, because the book was already a few years out of date at that point.
So you planned that anyway?
We had already been talking about doing a new edition, because I hadn't yet done one to cover the next day, let alone Black Star. And, you know, there was 5 years worth of stuff, more or less, to update. And then, of course, he had also died. So it was a case of going back through absolutely everything, because I'm always discovering new stuff about the old stuff as well. It wasn't just a case of bolting another couple of chapters on the end. I had huge amounts of extra stuff to add to some of the old stuff as well. So anyway, yeah, that was my 2016, actually. I spent most of that year working on it. So, and that edition is the most recent one, yeah.
And I believe he had seen the book, and he got in touch with you, didn't he?
He did, yes. He was always very kind and very supportive about the book, which I was always very, very grateful for. You know, it wasn't his way to... he would never have actually got actively involved in it, and nor did I ever ask him to, because I just didn't think that would have been appropriate. I didn't think he would have wanted to anyway. I'm sure he wouldn't have. But he was, you know, very kind about the book. And whenever a new edition came out, my publisher, you know, we would always send a sort of parcel of copies over to David Bowie's people in New York, and without my ever asking, David always would sign one and write a funny little message in it and send it back to me, which was incredibly so. As you can imagine, those copies are among my most prized possessions. He wrote funny little things in. I mean, my favourite one is the one he wrote. It was not. It was a couple of editions before he died, but he wrote something like, "Congratulations, Nick. A magnificent job. Of course, it's all completely wrong." But he did write. He did put a little smiley underneath. So I hope that was the old rogue. No, you know, very, very touching. And wow, what a wonderful thing. So yeah, I was very fortunate in that respect. Yeah.
Okay. The last time we'd seen him, the world had seen him, had been at, say, Live Aid.
That's right. Yeah. Exactly.
He had a massive hit with Absolute Beginners. I think that was early 86.
Early 86. Okay. Yes.
So we turned 40 at the beginning of 1987.
Yeah.
And certainly there must be a degree of soul searching. And again, that generation of rock stars, musicians, they were pretty much the first generation. So it must have been a slight nervousness on his part.
Yes.
Like, I better sound contemporary.
It's funny, isn't it? Because now 40 is no age for a rock star to be. But back then, I mean, of course, and we have to remember that this all came on the back of Live Aid. Something happened at Live Aid around that time that, you know, there was a feeling in the air that all of these old guard, or to you know, old, some slightly less complimentary word is how they were regarded by a lot of the music press. And a lot of it, you know, obviously they were sort of much more with it, younger bands around, people like the Smiths and the Cure, and Prince, of course, was in the ascendant. And there was a feeling, and I think Live Aid helped to sort of bolster it, however wonderful Live Aid was, that it was about time that these old men in their late 30s, which sounds ridiculous now, but they were due for a critical kicking, you know, and it was time to sweep them all away and have something else. And I think they all, absolutely, Bowie and McCartney and their generation, well, McCartney's a bit older, isn't he, but their generation suffered at the time. Anything that they did was going to be derided. And you know, this, to me, is, you know, the Glass Spider tour, which of course is regarded even more so than Never Let Me Down itself as Bowie's great sort of grand folly. Whatever he did at that point would probably have been laughed at. And the fact that he came out with this extraordinary three-ring circus rock thing, I mean, you know, he was kind of asking for it. But
I mean, 10 years ago we had the Philly Dogs, we had Diamond Dogs, we had a fairly groundbreaking...
Yeah.
Very theatrical set.
Yeah.
Which then I believe halfway through the tour, when he figured out how much money he wasn't making, then he quickly sliced it in half. But Glass Spider.
I don't think it was just about the money, though. So I think he got tired of playing to a script, which of course he always did over the years. You know, he would set up this great big show and then get incredibly bored with it quite quickly, because he famously, you know, he was quite open and unapologetic about it himself. He had a very short attention span, you know, and playing the same show for a couple of months, he would be, you know, and the Glass Spider tour went around the world for the best part of a year, nearly, well, something like that, May to November or something like that. So, yeah.
They said, when God, I was so relieved when that thing was over, we put the bloody spider in a field and set fire to it.
Yes, that's right. That's right. But I'm going to come back and defend the Glass Spider tour to you.
Wow.
Because...
You're a brave man.
I think that looking at it again in retrospect now, if you can, you know, watch the video, it was in many ways, I think it was very brave. I think it was, I think it probably works better as a video, that if you were 500 miles away at the back of the stadium watching right. these tiny scurrying figures running around and the sound wasn't that great, it probably wasn't that great an experience. But watching, you know, with the video, at least you have the, you know, luxury of watching it in your own home with nice big close-ups.
And
you,
yeah,
the mullet in all, yes, and the gold lame number with the sort of winged heels on the boots and all of it. Oh, goodness me, it's glorious. But no, I think there are aspects of it which are so far ahead of their time. You know, we can look at it now, of course, you know, that there is a tendency to, you know, it's easy to look at it and go, oh, look, Spinal Tap, Stonehenge coming down, all that, you know, yes, I get it. You're not wrong. But, well, indeed, that's right. But at the same time, there are really, really interesting ideas in that show. And okay, they didn't all come off, but the show was conceived as, I think, it was meant to be ironic. That's the first thing to say about it. Oh, yeah, no question. Right. Remember the Dancing in the Dark video, Bruce Springsteen, where he brings the girl out of the... It's Courtney Cox, wasn't it? Yeah, yeah. Okay, so that was a thing that had happened a couple of years before. And then at Live Aid, Bono did it for real with someone in the audience and danced with... In the Glass Spider tour, quite early on, second or third number, they do Bang Bang, the Iggy Pop number. And the dancers have already arrived on stage and done some big dance routines already. They've already done Glass Spider. And at the beginning of Bang Bang, Bowie throws himself at the audience and the dancers pull him back and they're all screaming and people reaching out. And then they pull a girl out of the audience and she's screaming and everything. And they dress her up in a dress and push her at Bowie and she's screaming and holding her head. And then Bowie comes up to her and, you know, holds her hand and she calms down a bit. And then he starts stroking her and then he starts groping her, at which point she smacks him in the face. And lo and behold, she's one of the dancers. And then they go into this raunchy pas de deux. And it's an ironic commentary on, well, firstly, on the sort of fakery of that Dancing in the Dark video, but also on the whole relationship between a rock star and the audience and the liberties that are taken. And, you know, he knew exactly what to do. And I think that's really witty. There are little spoken word bits between the songs in the Glass Spider thing as well, which are not terribly satisfactory because it's the dancers sort of miming to a thing. But, you know, there's one point, I think it's at the beginning of Absolute Beginning, when they go into that number, where they one of them says, "We can't have rock stars interacting with real people," or something like that. It's like, you know, and this is something that goes right through Bowie's career. You know, if you think about a far more recent song like "The Stars Are Out Tonight," you know, it's that video is all about the difference between celebrities and normal people. Exactly. And in inverted commas, yeah, and other things just sort of creatively, you know, the dancers on that tour, who, yes, they kind of look crazy and 80s and slightly bonkers, but, you know, they were an avant-garde New York dance troupe and they were doing interesting things. And it's very interesting, I think. Again, it's in the song Absolute Beginners a bit later on. Bowie comes to the front with one of the dancers, a guy called Victor Manoy, and together, with perfect synchronization, they do this beautiful Vogue dancing routine. So there's David Bowie taking Vogue dancing out of the gay bars of New York and doing it on stage 3 years before Madonna and her famous hit. So, hey, you know, he was
very underground.
Yeah, yeah.
Mid-80s New York in the gay bars and
right.
Really not a mainstream.
Yeah. Yeah, so you know, there's and all the sort of crazy stuff abseiling down from the set. This was new stuff at the time, and people did take it on, and there were interactive video things, and Heroes he interacts with some video footage. These were all stuff that, you know, U2 and people like that then took on and took to the next degree later on. And just the whole thing of the sort of synchronized dancers in a row doing mad stuff behind him. You know, if you look at the Fame routine in the Glass Spider video, for example, he does some extraordinary dancing in that with the dancers. And that's... Michael Jackson, interestingly enough, had not yet gone on a big solo tour at that point. We sort of think that he had, but his first big tour started later. That it was the Bad Tour.
There was no big Thriller.
Sure. Now, I mean, okay, of course he'd done the Thriller video with all that dancing in Arabia, but as an actual tour. So, you know, Bowie was, I'm not saying he was the first, he was certainly one of the first, though, who went out with a load of dancers, and that's just utterly de rigueur now, isn't it? You know, the whole Janet Jackson thing, the whole boy bands thing, the whole, you know, Beyonce, whatever you care to mention. Now, I'm not going to go so far as to say that Glass Spider invented all of that, but it certainly invented some of it. It really, really did.